From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The surviving son of Libya's slain leader Muammar Gaddafi, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, has been sentenced to death along with several other members of the former government. The trial was conducted in Tripoli, Libya, a country that, 4 years after the U.S. intervention, still has no functioning government. We begin with this report from RT's Eunan O'Neill.
Saif Gaddafi, one of the sons of deposed leader Muammar Gaddafi, has been sentenced to death along with eight others by a court. He'll be executed by firing squad after being convicted of war crimes during the 2011 uprising. The trial was held during a state of lawlessness across Libya, where rival militias have been fighting for power since Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown. Well, reporter Belle True covered the Middle East and North Africa uprisings at the time. She joins me on the phone now. Belle, bring us up to speed, if you can, on the developments.
Well, I've just spoken to the lawyers of Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, and the other main officials, including Gaddafi's last prime minister, Baghdadi al-Mahmoudi. And he told me that among the nine that have been sentenced to death, is Colonel Gaddafi's former spy chief and brother-in-law, Abdullah Sanusi, his last prime minister, as I said, Baghdadi al-Mahmoudi, and the head of intelligence, Abu Zaid Dawda. Now, he said to me, he called the trial a sham, and he said that the judges had been operating under duress. The trial is taking place in Tripoli, the capital, which has been held by a coalition of armed forces and Islamist-leaning politicians called Libya Dawn since last summer. On the eve of the session of the trial, the country's official Minister of Justice, who's operating in kind of self-imposed exile in the East, condemned it, the whole legal hearing, as illegal, and claimed also that the lawyers and the judges were acting under duress from this militia. So it's a little bit of a chaos at the moment. What we do know is Saif al-Islam is still not in Tripoli. He's being held in Zintan, some 140 kilometres southwest of the capital. So he's not under threat of being executed by the firing squad, but Colonel Gaddafi's former officials are, as they are being held in Tripoli.
How can this actually be carried out by shooting squad if it's two rival factions, one holding him, one wanting to sentence him?
Well, that's exactly the confusion that we're facing now in Libya. As you rightly said, Saif al-Islam is being held by a militia in Zintan that supports the internationally recognised government, that's against those militias that are holding the capital where the hearing took place. So at the moment, he's stuck between these two armed groups, and it's unlikely that the Zintanis who are holding him will hand him over, particularly, as I said, they are pro-government, and the official government has condemned this trial as illegal. So for the moment, he's in relatively safe hands in this area, southwest of the capital, and we'll have to see, you know, what will happen in the next few days and whether, you know, a new trial will start or whether he will be handed over to the officials in the capital.
Okay, right after the verdict, we in fact talked to one of Saif Gaddafi's lawyers. He told us that from the very beginning, there was no hope for justice in this trial. Take a listen.
It's clearly a complete show trial in respect to all of the defendants. And the Libyan Minister of Justice himself has condemned the trial as completely illegitimate. It's basically trial by militia. The judges there are under the complete control of armed militia who are running the Al-Habba detention facility and running the trial. There should be some appeal process, but you know, as to what that involves, I don't know, and there's no reason to think that it would be any genuine you know, legal process either. As I said, the militia are in control of the whole process, and so you know, there's no liberty really of the judges to act as judges. The prosecutor and defence lawyers aren't able to do any proper job. I don't know if you know, I mean, the prosecution didn't call prosecution witnesses, they just relied on confessions which were coerced, you know, by torture. Defence teams were allowed to bring two witnesses, I think, who didn't have protective measures. And so, in fact, you know, there's no way defence witnesses could testify in any safety. And all this happening in Tripoli under, you know, complete insecurity and where You know, there are killings every day, and there's absolutely no scope, no possibility for any sort of a fair trial in Tripoli.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen grows more desperate by the day, as Saudi airstrikes have reduced the country's infrastructure to rubble. Aid agencies have warned that the key infrastructure in Yemen is on the verge of collapse due to the ongoing Saudi strikes. Saudi war plans have targeted not only health services, water supplies, and telecommunications, but also construction material factories, hampering reconstruction efforts, as Press TV's Mohammed Al-Attab reports.
This is Yemen's province of Amran, which has been fiercely bombarded by Saudi Arabia, like many other Yemeni regions. Press TV carried out a field visit to a cement plant in Amran. The factory was bombed and destroyed by the airstrikes. Observers say this kind of attack reveals Riyadh's intention to destroy the infrastructure of the impoverished Arab country.
Most of the country's infrastructure has been destroyed, this besides the government buildings and residential areas. And to add salt to the injury, they destroyed cement factories.
Bombardment of the country's cement factories in the provinces of Amran, Dal, and Taiz has doubled the prices of cement in Yemen.
Due to the bombardment of Amran's cement factory and other national cement factories, and the Saudi siege and the imports of the different materials, the price of cement has skyrocketed because of the Saudi siege and the imports of different materials. It's a real crime against these poor people.
Cement factories were not the only target of Saudi warplanes. They also bombed food plants to create what many people here say more hunger in the country, which has seen tight siege on the import of basic necessities and commodities. The Saudi aggression against Yemen continues despite a self-declared ceasefire. Riyadh had already violated several ceasefires in Yemen. The onslaught has claimed nearly 4,900 lives and displaced more than a million Yemenis. It is an all-out war waged by Saudi Arabia against the civilians in the impoverished Arab country. Rights activists say Saudi rulers should be taken to international criminal court for crimes against humanity. Mohammed Al-Attab, Press TV, Amran Province.
As bad as things are in Yemen, they're worse in Syria and have been for the past 4.5 years. And they may be getting even worse. NATO met on Tuesday to discuss the expansion of military operations in Syria and Iraq by the U.S. and Turkey. Press TV's Bardi Ahanadar has more.
NATO has convened an emergency meeting in Brussels to discuss Turkey's airstrikes on the ISIL and Kurdish positions in Syria and Iraq. The meeting was called by Turkey under Article 4 of the Military Alliance's founding treaty. The clause allows NATO members to request a summit if their territorial integrity or security is in danger. Addressing the meeting, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the military alliance will stand firmly by Turkey in the face of, quote, terrible acts of terror.
Our condolences go to the Turkish government and the families of the victims touched by these terrible acts of terror. Terrorism in all its forms can never be tolerated or justified. It is right and timely that we hold this meeting today to address the instability on Turkey's doorstep and on NATO's border. NATO is in developments very closely, and we stand in strong solidarity with our ally, Turkey.
This is NATO's fifth such emergency meeting in its 66-year history. A series of attacks happened on Turkey's territory following its airstrikes targeting ISIL and PKK positions in Syria and Iraq. Meanwhile, Ankara and Washington have agreed on a plan to create what they call a safe zone in northern Syria to protect the so-called moderate militants there. Turkey says it prefers Syria's moderate opposition forces to replace the ISIL near its border.
And as NATO discussed expanding military operations in Syria and neighboring Iraq, UN Humanitarian Affairs Chief Stephen O'Brien told the Security Council Tuesday that the Syrian crisis is, quote, the most acute, unrelenting, and shameful blot on the world's humanitarian conscience, closed quote. He stressed that there is no military solution to the Syrian crisis. Deanne Penn filed this report from the United Nations.
Mr. O'Brien said a political solution to the Syrian crisis is more urgent than ever to end the cycle of violence. He detailed how 5 years of fighting have torn the country's economic and social fabric, causing death, destruction, and displacement. It has also impeded aid delivery efforts.
I am shocked and outraged. Syria today, amongst sadly and appallingly an enlarging pool of humanitarian need and human misery across many parts of the world, but notably in this region, is the most acute, unrelenting, and shameful blot on the world's humanitarian conscience. I hope that my proposed visit to Damascus next month will provide an opportunity to constructively engage with the government to address some of the significant access challenges that seriously impede humanitarian operations and prevent ordinary Syrians from getting the assistance they so desperately need.
Despite the numerous obstacles, Mr. O'Brien spoke of how UN agencies and their partners are supporting millions of needy Syrians. He said in the first part of this year alone, they had provided nearly 6 million people each month with food. However, more than 4 million Syrians are located in areas which are difficult to access. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
O'Brien spoke to the press after he made his presentation and took questions.
Good afternoon, everyone. I've just briefed the Security Council on the situation in Syria, and I believe you have been given a copy of my full statement. The Secretary General's report on the humanitarian situation in Syria highlights the horrors of this brutal conflict and the immense suffering endured by the people of Syria, where today 12.2 million people need our help. I told council members that violence has continued to escalate, with barrel bombs and other explosive weapons in populated areas causing by far the most civilian deaths and injuries. And intense fighting across the country has led to a major surge in displacement. So far this year, more than 1 million people have been forced to flee their homes. While the conflict continues, destroying the development gains made over the last few generations, I reminded the Council that the immense trauma and emotional toll on families, especially their young people, will profoundly affect future generations. It's unacceptable. It's a terrible and unnecessary waste. About a quarter of the population, 4.6 million people, are living in areas that are extremely hard for us to reach. And we know that some 420,000 are besieged by parties to the conflict. I explained to members of the Council that the United Nations and partners are doing our best to reach as many people as we can every month with essential supplies and services, but access is severely restricted. We must have rapid and sustainable access without delay or hindrance. I plan to visit Syria next month, and I hope that this will be an opportunity to address this and other challenges. Only a political solution can prove that the world cares about Syria's people and the misery they are going through. This is now more urgent than ever. As I said to the Council, this is the most acute, relentless, and shameful blot on the world's humanitarian conscience today. Now, I'm happy to take a few questions.
Thank you. Michelle Nichols from Reuters. What more do you think the Security Council could do to help with the humanitarian situation? What action could they take? And who are you hoping to meet with in Damascus?
The details of my trip to Syria have yet to be finalised. I hope, of course, to meet government representatives at all levels when I'm there. And I also hope to have the opportunity to go to Homs and on a field trip to see as much as I can with my own eyes. So that's obviously very important. In terms of what the Security Council can do, I think primarily maybe using some of the humanitarian issues as an entry point to discussions. But the primary objective is to find a political proposed solution that is going to be something that can be adhered to by the parties. There is no humanitarian solution. There can only be a political solution. There is equally no military solution. So we will do everything we can. But by doing that, that is what would secure the greatest possible access. It's that unimpeded access, which gives us the greatest opportunity to meet the humanitarian needs. And if peace was to be secured tomorrow, there would still be continuing humanitarian need for some considerable period to come, as the needs are now so acute, so widespread, let alone the amount of people who have either been internally displaced or the amount of people who have had to flee across the borders into neighboring countries who so generously are hosting those people. So it's vital. During the course of the presentations on the humanitarian situation in Syria in February and April this year by my predecessor, there were a series of asks, which I know you will have already seen, and I simply stated that all those asks remain. So in terms of what the process here can do in terms of the Security Council helping the humanitarian access and delivery.
Sure. Matthew Lee, Inner City Press. I wanted to ask you about the Yarmouk camp. There's a lot of confusion about how it was classified as no longer besieged, if no aid has gotten in since March and to the surrounding area since June. Can you explain how OCHA makes that determination and what it, you know, what impact it may have on Yarmouk, but also how it was made?
That's a helpful question. Thank you very much, because the question of the classification is quite strictly applied, so that if a central population or a city or village is besieged, then it is because no aid can get in. There had been some hope in the past that even some medical, very restricted medical aid could get into the besieged areas, but not even that is getting through, maybe except in one very small instance. So besieged, yes, does mean that nothing's going in or coming out. What we can say, and this has actually been the case now in June and July, so it's been for 3 months, that the three neighboring areas of Yalda, Babila, and Baitsam, I think commonly known as YBB, there is access to those three areas, and there is movement of the people in Yarmouk between their area and those three areas, some people staying in those three areas, others collecting life-saving commodities, medical supplies, and taking them back into Yarmouk. So by definition, that means they are no longer besieged as such. Unquestionably, they're extraordinarily hard to reach, and that does not mean in practical terms there's any diminution or deprioritization of our concern or their needs. It's purely a question of definition of what is a siege. So when we say lift the siege in relation to the 420 in besieged areas, that is because that's what needs to happen to have any access to those. That would not be the case in Yarmouk, because we do know we are getting some of the aid through by these neighboring three areas being available. One over here. I don't know who's next.
I'll take another one.
Go up here. Yeah, you might need the microphone up here.
Thank you. Luke Vargas with Talk Radio News Service. You mentioned in your briefing the millions of people who could be affected if there was unimpeded humanitarian access. And in light of the announcements about this safe zone that the U.S. and Turkey are pursuing, have those two countries been in touch with your office about the geographical area they're going to try to target, and specifically the border crossings that they may try to liberate from, I guess, terrorist control?
It will, of course, not surprise you that we're in constant touch with all the people and trying to follow where proposals are arising. It's in particular very important that in the shifting ground that there is, that we're always keeping under review what can be the crossing points, where we can have access, indeed where we have to close access because of either uncontrolled dangers or whatever. And during the course of my statement, I did refer to the number of humanitarian workers, 77, who have been very tragically killed. So we need to be extremely careful to look to our duties there. On the question of safe zones, again, we certainly want to work very closely with whatever is proposed, but there is a very clear need from the humanitarian's point of view is you don't want to declare something a safe zone, wherever it may be, which would then, of course, very quickly attract people, given that we have a sort of a very severely traumatized series of communities and populations around Syria, where I use the phrase, you know, the awful choice that many people have to flee or to stay and die. And that is what you don't want to do is to call something a safe zone, people flee to it. But if it hasn't got sufficient protection, as our primary objective is the protection of civilians, we need to make sure that there is protection in place, and that is not always the role of the humanitarians. It needs to be established by others, including what people you have actually on the ground to ensure that protection. A possible thing to guarantee, then, from our point of view, we have to be cautious about where a safe zone could actually step up and be part of the contribution towards the protection of civilians. So everything's under review.
Where the military strikes might be planned by Turkey and the United States, and are you prepared to make sure there aren't, you know, humanitarian actors in those areas?
Well, if I may say, it's a very good try, but even if I did, I wouldn't possibly tell you. I don't know.
Just a follow-up on that. Have you conveyed that message to the Turkish government that to be very careful about calling it a safe zone, if that's in fact what they're trying to set up?
No, we're in dialogue. So I mean, this is live time. So we're in a discussion, and all these points are, of course, sensitive. The use of language is sensitive in this area, as well as the practical application of what is possible, what can be negotiated, what can stick. And so we're part of that process, but it has to, at the end, it's a political process. It's drawing on all the inputs before decisions can be secured. So we're part of that process, but not the primary decision maker.
The Security Council was set to play host to an international drama reminiscent of the Cold War during its session Wednesday after Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, announced that his country plans to veto a U.S.-backed resolution seeking to establish a UN tribunal over the downing of Malaysian Air Flight MH17 last year in East Ukraine. That resolution, to be brought to a vote Wednesday, will be the first time in UN history that the body is asked to have a tribunal handle charges resulting from the shooting down of an airliner. This was Ambassador Churkin speaking Monday.
What's being proposed is the creation of a tribunal on the basis of the UN Charter's Chapter 7 dealing with threats to peace and security. But never before has a tribunal been established when a passenger jet was downed. For example, when a Russian plane was downed by the Ukrainian army in 2001, or when an Iranian jet was shot down by the US over the Persian Gulf in 1988. The MH17 investigation is in two parts. One team is conducting a technical investigation, which Russian experts have only limited access to. While five countries are also conducting a criminal investigation. We know nothing about that investigation, as it's being carried out in secret. We understand that any tribunal would be based on that secret investigation, but that's like being offered a pig in a poke, and accepting that would be rash.
Serge Trishkovich, political analyst and author, has himself testified before a UN tribunal, that one investigating the fighting in the former Yugoslavia during the 1990s. Speaking with RT Monday, he offered his observations on the issues raised by Ambassador Churkin.
If we look at the actual five countries, it's the Netherlands, Belgium, Australia, Malaysia, and Ukraine, which of course has an axe to grind in the proceedings. Of course, Belgium and the Netherlands are NATO members. Australia is a close ally of the United States. And it is to be feared, it is greatly to be feared, that this investigation will be politically motivated and that its results are almost preordained. The second problem is that the experience we've had so far with UN tribunals has been most unsatisfactory. In particular, I have in mind the International Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia at The Hague, which is a political body par excellence. Let us just recall that it unsealed the indictment against Slobodan Milosevic at the height of the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia in the spring of 1999. So the combination of the two, on the one side, an investigation which is most likely to be politically motivated and where it is absolutely impossible to even imagine that they would allow the possibility of Ukraine being the guilty party in the proceedings, because the countries sanctioning Russia, the countries that have a political interest in condemning either Russia directly or indirectly by establishing, quote-unquote, that it was the rebels in eastern Ukraine armed with Russian weapons that downed the plane, that would, of course, be more grist for the mill of the propaganda machine in the Western world. And let me repeat, the experience with UN tribunals so far is that once the Secretary General has the blank check to appoint the judges and other officials It is done more or less on automatic pilot in the interest of the predominant political party. And of course, Ban Ki-moon comes from South Korea, and we know that South Korea too is a close ally of the US. This would be a propaganda circus with all the attendant media distortions that we've seen over the past year and a half. And I think that Russia is well advised not only to veto the resolution, but to demand the establishment of a truly independent international commission of inquiry that would include representatives of the Russian side. Because the way this investigation has been conducted so far does not inspire any confidence whatsoever that its findings will be objective and truthful.
This past Saturday, Newark, New Jersey saw the biggest march and rally since the 1967 uprising that saw the city occupied by the U.S. military. Called the Million Person March Against Police Brutality, the crowd, although considerably less than a million, was large enough, spirited, and ready to be heard. Speakers discussed the cases of dozens of black men and women killed by police in recent years, including those of Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, and many others. One of the speakers was Hortensia Peterson, the aunt of 28-year-old Akai Gurley, who was gunned down in a Brooklyn stairwell by NYPD officer Peter Liang on November 20th, 2014.
I stand in solidarity with all parents, all family of police brutality. It's an honor and a privilege to stand here and see that the struggle is not over. It's an honor and a privilege to know that the dead cannot cry out for justice. It is a duty of the living to do so for them. We are the living. Akai is dead. Eric Garner is dead. Tamir Rice is dead. Sandra Bland is dead. Why? Police brutality. We are sick and tired of being sick and tired of our black men, our black sisters, our black mothers. We are sick and tired of our family members being murdered. We are sick and tired of burying our loved ones. We are sick and tired of being abused by the police department. Those that were served took an oath to serve and protect. Who are they serving? Who are they protecting? Themselves. They're not protecting us. My name is Hortensia Peterson. On November 20th, 2014, my nephew Akai Gurley was murdered. My nephew was walking down the stairs in the Pink House Project in Brooklyn, New York. The elevator wasn't working, so him and his friend decided to take the stairs. Is it a crime to take the stairs?
No.
No. Is it a crime to wait for the elevator?
No.
But because of vertical patrol, my nephew's no longer here. Because of militarized policing, my nephew's no longer here. Eric Garner told Daniel Pantaleo that he can't breathe. I can't breathe. We can't breathe until police brutality has stopped. Sandra Bland can't breathe. What was she doing? Exercising her rights, asking questions. Why are you arresting me? Why are you stopping me? Is it a crime to ask an officer a question? Is it a crime to be a black educated woman in today's society? Is it a crime to ask why? We, the people of the United States, but guess what? The we does not include black and brown lives. The we include privilege. The we include whites. The we include governors. The we include police commissioners, mayors that sells out its people. We are the people. We have a voice, and our voice says, stop with the police brutality. Stop with murdering our loved ones. Stop, stop, stop. We cannot do it no more.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.